Hello, my name is Mathilde Groppo, and I'm an associate in the media litigation team at Court Rock. I'm joined by Romana Canetti, a barrister at 4 King's Bench Walk, who spent several years working in-house for media organizations before returning to private practice. For this TMT webinar, we will be talking about legal developments in defamation since the Court of Appeals judgment in La Chaux, the case that led to the Supreme Court's landmark ruling on the new serious harm threshold in the 2013 Defamation Act. We'll be discussing general trends in the law of defamation, examining specific developments in defamation law and practice, and looking at changes in applicable procedure and cost rules. To start us off, I will hand over to Romana, who will be looking at general trends in the law of defamation.
Thank you,
Thank you,
Mathilde.
Mathilde. So
It's just
it's
over
just
6.5 years. Okay, I'm getting the echo again.
Yeah, I can hear that as well. That's really weird.
And I'm in a different house using a different broadband and a different machine.
Nice. And you can't hear it now, can you?
Nope. And I couldn't hear it when we were talking before. Should I
Yeah.
just start again and maybe it's gone?
Yeah, try again.
Thank you, Mathilde. Yes, so it's just over 6.5 years since the Defamation Act came into force, and the number of claims continues to rise. The most recent annual judicial statistics, those for 2019, once again show an increase in the number of defamation claims issued, up by 22% on 2018, which themselves are up 107% on 2017. Continuing the upward trend which began that year after the Court of Appeal gave its judgment in La Chaux. Lord Leicester, who died last month, will be horrified by those figures, it's probably safe to say. His stated objective when introducing his defamation bill to Parliament in 2010 had been to reduce the chilling effect on freedom of expression and encourage the free exchange of ideas and information whilst providing an effective and proportionate remedy to anyone whose reputation is unfairly damaged. In other words, his aim had been to swing the pendulum back towards Article 10 rights, thereby dislodging London's dubious crown as libel capital of the world. The most radical innovation in Lord Leicester's bill, designed to filter out trivial and unmeritorious claims, was Section 1, which, as enacted, provides that the statement is not defamatory, that is, actionable, unless it has caused or is likely to cause serious harm to the reputation of the claimant, or as subsection 2 stipulates, serious financial loss in the case of a body trading for profit. Just over a year has gone by since the Supreme Court's judgment in La Chaux. As we'll see later, it disagreed with the Court of Appeal's interpretation of the serious harm test, which had rendered it effectively toothless. And we can only hope, therefore, that next year's figures reflect that ruling by the Supreme Court as judges begin to apply the newly clarified law, or even better, as claimants are deterred from issuing in the first place because they are unlikely to be able to establish that they have suffered or are likely to suffer serious harm as a result of something published about them. In the meantime, claims arising from politics seem to comfortably clear the serious harm hurdle. There have been a rash of recently politically orientated claims, notably, it seems, ones arising from divisions within the Labour Party or the Labour movement. These have kept the serious harm threshold at the forefront of judicial minds. Some examples are Turley and Unite, Riley and Murray, Bergen and News Group, Millett and Jeremy Corbyn. Not to mention the well-publicised recent settlement by the new Labour leader Keir Starmer of claims brought by former disaffected Labour HQ whistleblowers in an unprecedented way against their own party. With several other figures from the Corbyn days apparently limbering up for legal action if reports are to be believed, perhaps this too can count as a mini trend of its own. But more importantly, in terms of its long-term implications, this year has brought another landmark Supreme Court judgment, this time one ruling on the ambit of the new statutory public interest test in Section 4 of the Act, a provision that was described by Lord McNally to the House of Lords Committee as one that was at the heart of the bill. Once again, in Serafin, the Supreme Court has overturned the Court of Appeal's restrictive interpretation of the statute and has come down as Parliament intended, or has decided that what Parliament had intended was to come down in favour of freedom of expression. Whether this is going to have much effect on the rising tide of defamation claims that we're currently seeing remains to be seen. And perhaps now we should move on to the next slide, which is number 8. And a question from you, Mathilde, I think.
Yes, I was just going to ask whether data protection adds much to libel claims these days.
Well, that's an interesting question, Mathilde, because obviously that we are seeing lots of claims with multiple causes, based on multiple causes of actions in the 6 years since the Defamation Act has been in force. One of those alternative causes of action, of course, is data protection. Other ones that we are commonly seeing are harassment and malicious falsehood. There is a case, actually a recent case, that usefully illustrates the interplay between these various causes of action, which are used by claimants either to protect or to avenge alleged breaches of their reputational rights. And that case is Sube and News Group and Express Newspapers Limited. There was a judgment handed down in this May by Mr. Justice Warby, now recently elevated to the Court of Appeal. And his judgment provides welcome reassurance, actually, to the press that such alternative claims shouldn't be seen by claimants as an easy option to be substituted where libel claims have failed or are likely to fail. In Suba, the claimants were a married couple who moved to the UK from France together with their 9 children. Interestingly, it was they who had originally contacted the press, hoping to garner some support after rejecting the offer of a five-bedroom house from Luton Borough Council for themselves and their 9 children. The media weren't quite as sympathetic as they had hoped, and the resulting coverage was highly critical of them, both in published articles and in subsequent user-generated comments. The disappointed claimants issued proceedings for defamation, harassment and breaches of data protection. The defamation claim was struck out in 2018 because the publications were held not to meet the serious harm threshold. So the 2020 proceedings focused on the harassment and the data protection elements of the claim. The data protection part of the claim focused on the premise that the articles touched on the claimant's sensitive personal data, namely their race, their provenance, and the possibility that they had engaged in criminal conduct. Mr. Justice Warby strongly rejected, although he didn't have to decide that issue because the claim failed for a procedural reason, which I'll move on to in a minute. He did mention in passing that the fact that they were French was not racial and wasn't sensitive personal data, and that in fact there had been no allegations that the claimants were fraudulent. So there was no allegation of criminality in the articles. But actually in the end, the claim was struck out because the claimants had been a little bit hasty in issuing, because a data controller under the Data Protection Act has 21 days in which to respond to a request to cease processing personal data. But the claim was issued before the 21 days had elapsed, so that disposed of that. As for the media harassment by publication limb of the claim, which that element was on trial only for the second time, the first being Trimmingham and Associated back in 2012, that claim had been dismissed. In Suba, the claimants pleaded that the series of publications about them amounted to harassment. Mr. Justice Warby found otherwise, his judgment saying very firmly that nothing short of a conscious or negligent abuse of media freedom will justify a finding of harassment by media publication. It will be a rare and exceptional case, he said, in which these criteria are satisfied. He found that the claimants had failed to prove that either defendant was guilty of a course of conduct sufficient to satisfy the requirements of harassment legislation, which he said had to be conduct amounting to a criminal standard, because under the Protection of Harassment Act, harassment can be either criminal or civil proceedings may arise from the harassment. But Mr. Justice Warby said that it was the harassment had to be to the criminal standard, which he found it wasn't in this case. Whilst this comes as comfort to mainstream media publishers, it doesn't and hasn't precluded successful claims against individuals bent on harassing others by way of, say, a barrage of defamatory posts on social media. I'll tell you which case that was later on. Whilst all this does, on the face of it, provide some comfort for champions of freedom of expression, defendants should bear in mind that for the Article 10, Article 8 balancing exercise to work in their favour, which ultimately is what certainly claims under the Data Protection Act eventually involve, there must have been a prior assessment at the pre-publication stage of the justification for potentially breaching somebody's Article 8 rights. With regards to the GDPR, there is, of course, the exemption for reasons of freedom of expression and information, which is available to those in undertaking journalistic, academic, artistic, and literary activities. And that can be found at Schedule 2, Part 5 of the 2018 Data Protection Act. And its effect is that it exempts people operating for those purposes from compliance with several of the data protection principles, if they're able to demonstrate that they reasonably believe that compliance would be incompatible with those special purposes. And I'm wondering whether that reasonable belief requirement rings a bell with anyone. It should, because it's the same wording used in the public interest defense of Section 4 of the Defamation Act, which we'll look at in the defamation context later on. But for now, to establish reasonable belief, it should be noted that the Data Protection Act specifically cites compliance with certain industry codes of practice, currently Ofcom for broadcasters or the BBC guidelines and the editor's code of practice, although others may be added, as determinative of the reasonableness of a controller's belief that publication would be in the public interest. So keeping an audit trail, in other words, evidence of the relevant decision-making process, has never been more important. And just quickly touching on malicious falsehood claims, we do still occasionally see them either in tandem with or as an alternative to defamation claims, partly because the single meaning rule doesn't apply, and also because the statement complained of doesn't have to bear a defamatory meaning. And although they both defamation and malicious falsehood deal with the publication of false statements, in a malicious falsehood claim, the claimant doesn't have to prove damage to reputation, although they do have to prove that the statement is untrue, which is a burden, a reversal of the burden of proof in a defamation claim, where it's the defendant who has to prove the truth of a statement under Section 2. Secondly, the claimant in malicious falsehood has to be able to establish that the defendant acted maliciously or was at the very least reckless as to the truth of the statement. And that can be quite a hard burden to discharge. So to sum up, whether data protection, the relatively new kid on the block, overtakes defamation as the cause of action to go for, or whether we continue to see a potpourri of alternative and cumulative causes of action remains to be seen. But I think it's safe to say that the combined effect of the two Supreme Court judgments on the Defamation Act, the first being Lachaud and the second Serafin, and I'll talk about those later, will hopefully leave the field clearer for those claimants who really have suffered indefensible reputational damage.
Thank you. You were just talking about some form of audit trail. Would that be relevant to your Section 4 defence as well?
Yes, I think it would be very relevant to a Section 4 defence, because it would go to it would end up being evidence, or it could go to the reasonableness of a publisher's belief that to publish something was in the public interest. And there are several cases which they're on a slide that we'll move on to further on. But several cases, several defences have failed on because the defendants were unable to point to a reasonable belief.
Thank you. To wrap up our section on general trends, I'm going to take us to slide 9, which looks at preliminary issue trials. This is another interesting development that has occurred in the past couple of years. It relates to the number of preliminary issue trials, or PITs. And what is very clear, and what has very clearly happened over the past 2 years, is that the number of serious harm PITs has considerably decreased, whereas the number of meaning PITs has increased, and these are very much becoming the norm. So why is this the case? Looking at serious harm PITs, first of all, one of the purposes of the Defamation Act 2013, which Romana was mentioning, was to bring about a procedural change which would allow to resolve key issues in libel proceedings at an early stage, which would encourage settlement and prevent protracted and costly litigation. It was hoped that the serious harm requirement in Section 1 of the Act would act as a limitation to prevent trivial claims from proceeding. And in line with this reasoning, in various cases, including the case of Ains, it was considered that the Section 1 requirement could properly be looked at as a preliminary issue. However, when Mr. Justice Warby gave judgment in the High Court in the case of Lasho, he was actually cautious about preliminary issue trials. And his view was that it would usually be preferable for this issue to be tried as a preliminary issue. But on the facts of the case, the volume of the written evidence and the length of the cross-examination went well beyond what he considered to be necessary. He was hopeful that these issues could be properly addressed by adequate case management, but his optimistic outlook was not in fact met. And in the case of Thiedem, the judge recognized that there was actually an escalation in these PITs. This was very apparent in that case from the cost budgets of the parties, which totaled £170,000 for both parties in respect of the PIT alone, which included VAT, but did not include additional liabilities. This was clearly at odds with the general criteria, which are used to determine whether or not a PIT should be ordered, and which includes whether the PIT will significantly cut down on court time involved in pre-trial preparation and in connection with the trial itself, and whether such an order will increase costs or delay the trial. Worse than that, the judge was actually of the view that in Thiedem, the hearing of the evidence had actually added little or nothing to the conclusions that an experienced defamation judge would have drawn from simply reading the words complained of at trial. Ultimately, in the case of Brown and Bauer, Mr. Justice Warby expressed view that a preliminary issue trial would actually not be proportionate, where the trial of serious harm would raise substantial issues of fact and law, which would require disclosure and witness statements. And since then, the number of serious harm PITs has considerably shrunk, and to my knowledge, there haven't been any in 2020. On the contrary, in the same case of Brown and Bauer, Mr. Justice Warby clearly recognized the value of a meaning PIT. His view was that a determination on meaning would be short and relatively inexpensive, that it would stand a chance to bring an early end to the proceedings, and that failing that, it would at the very least narrow the issues between the parties. In light of these comments, it's very clear that a meaning PIT is in line with the overriding objective of the CPR. There's an obvious counterexample in the case of Stocker and Stocker, which was a meaning determination which went all the way to the Supreme Court, but that's very much an exception rather than the rule. In practice, these meaning PITs can nowadays proceed without a hearing on the basis of written submissions. And the parties can also dispense with cost budgeting if they agree to keep their costs within the limits indicated in Price and MGN, which range from £20,000 to £25,000, which was described as the top end of the range, to £30,000, which would potentially be hard to justify. It's quite interesting to note that in later cases, and in particular in the case of Poroshenko, where the claimant sought to refuse to agree to such an application for a PIT, the PIT was in fact ordered and an adverse cost order was made against the claimant, which I think gives a pretty strong indication about the fact that these meaning PITs are considered to be efficient by the court. There was no indication as to when such a PIT should occur, and this could be done at any time before the full trial. This approach was criticized in a series of cases, which include Poroshenko, which I was just talking about, but also Morgan and Bukova. In those cases, the judge expressed the view that as a matter of case management, meaning should be determined before any further costs are incurred after issuing proceedings and filing the particulars of claim. And so essentially a PIT on meaning must occur before a defense is filed, because pleading a defense on the basis of a disputed meaning could potentially create a huge waste in costs. In 2020, there have been a great number of meaning PITs. It's very clear that they're quick, that they're cost-effective, and that they're very much becoming the norm where meaning is disputed.
So are there any circumstances in which a court may refuse to order a PIT on meaning?
Yes, although they've become more common. In 2019, for instance, in the case of Dallin and Middle East Eye, Mr. Justice Nicklin refused to order a PIT. He based his decision on the fact that the principal defense being run was a public interest defense, and in that case, the meaning does not set the parameters of the defense. Overall, this is very much in line with general practice and the general guidance on PITs. And the reasoning is a meaning PIT will be ordered where it will save time, cost, and resources in connection with an issue which will need to be determined by the court in order to determine the case. Thank you for your question, Romana. That brings our discussion about general trends in defamation law to a conclusion. And we're now going to move on to slide 10, so specific developments in the substantive law of defamation. And I will hand over to Romana to talk you through slide 11, which is about section 1 of the Defamation Act 2013.
Yes, thank you, Mathilde. So, of course, as we heard earlier, Section 1 introduces a requirement of serious harm as a prerequisite to a defamation claim, and it was regarded as a cornerstone of the new statutory regime. And it provides that a statement is not actionable unless it has caused or is likely to cause serious harm. The explanatory notes to the Act say that it builds on the common law and in particular on the case of Thornton and Telegraph Media Group. That was a case which had established a necessary threshold of substantial harm to reputation in order for a statement to be actionable, because traditionally a defamatory statement was actionable per se, but this established that there was a threshold requirement at common law. Parliament decided to raise that threshold to serious and also to raise the bar by altering the terminology of tendency, which had been used in Thornton to cause harm, to likely. And in fact, the MP, Jonathan Janoglu, told the parliamentary committee that tendency would have made it more likely that doubtful claims would be able to proceed. So it was a considered and deliberate decision. The practical effect of Section 1 as enacted polarised legal opinion from the outset. Defendant lawyers argued that the wording did raise the bar, whilst claimant lawyers insisted that the common law was largely unaltered and all that a claimant still has to show is that a statement has an inherent tendency to damage reputation to a sufficiently serious extent, which at common law had been substantial and now was serious. And such a tendency, argued claimant lawyers, made a defamatory statement actionable per se. So effectively, let's not frighten the horses, nothing too much had changed. Mirror Group was the first post-Section 1 serious harm case. It proved uncontroversial because the threshold was found not to be met, largely because the defendant swiftly published an apology after the claimants complained a few days after the publication of the article, within days after the publication of the article. So it was difficult for them, impossible for them, really, it was held, to prove that their reputation had suffered serious harm. Section 1 was most starkly and famously put to the test with the publication in early 2014, a matter of weeks after the Defamation Act came into force, of a series of articles in the Independent, Evening Standard and the Huffington Post reporting the allegations of a British woman concerning her ex-husband, Bruno Lachaud, a French resident, of Dubai, a French national resident of, and who lived in Dubai. He sued. At a preliminary hearing, the meaning of the articles was found to be that he had been violent and abusive to his wife during their marriage, that he'd used Sharia law to divorce her, that he'd used United Emirates law to deprive her of custody and contact with her son, who at the time was about 3 years old, and that he had callously taken that son away from her and later falsely accused her of abducting the little boy. Obviously, these were not trivial allegations. The question was whether they had caused or were likely to cause serious harm to Mr. Lachaud's reputation. There was, as you touched upon earlier, Mathilde, there was evidence was heard at a preliminary hearing. It wasn't so much that it was a serious harm hearing, it was a hearing of an abusive process application, a Jamil application brought by the Huffington Post. On the basis that it was an abusive process for Mr. Lachaud to have brought his claim in the UK. That did involve hearing evidence from Mr. Lachaud, and his evidence to Mr. Justice Warby was did include that three people that he knew had in the UK had read the articles, but that they knew him and so they hadn't believed the allegations within the articles. Nonetheless, Mr. Justice Warby found that the combined effect of the meaning of the words, Mr. Lachaud's situation, the extent of the publication in mainstream outlets, and the inherent probability that he may one day meet someone who might read those articles and think the worst of him, added up to the likelihood of future serious harm to reputation. So it met the likely to cause test, even if his reputation hadn't already suffered serious harm. But in deciding this, Mr. Justice Warby did agree that Section 1 was a game changer. In other words, he more or less endorsed the defendant's lawyer's interpretation of what Section 1 had done to the law, and that he agreed it was a game changer and that it did require evidence of serious harm. The Court of Appeal, the case moved up to the Court of Appeal, which rewound the clock. Disagreeing not only with Mr. Justice Warby's interpretation of what Section 1 did to the law, but also, while they did so, dismissing the newspaper's appeal and endorsing the claimant-friendly actionability per se argument. In other words, the Court of Appeal found that serious harm to reputation can be assumed if the words themselves are sufficiently defamatory. The matter clearly needed to be decided. There was a further appeal to the Supreme Court, and Lord Sumption's judgment last year delivered a bracing a reversal of the status quo as recently established by the Court of Appeal. And he explicitly said that his judgment accepts the newspaper's interpretation of the Act. The issue, said Lord Sumption, must turn primarily on the language of Section 1. This shows very clearly, he said, that it not only raises the threshold of seriousness, but it requires its application to be determined by reference to the actual facts about its impact, not just the meaning of the words. Slide 11. In slide 11, you will find a quick run through. I haven't got time here really to go into the few cases that there have been on section 1.2, which is the issue of financial loss to bodies trading for profit. But there are some cases set out there.
Thank you, Romana. You were just mentioning that facts are required to establish serious harm. So is there any room for inference on that issue?
Yes, very much so, Mathilde. In Lachaud itself, of course, the judge and this was an approach that was endorsed by Lord Sumption, drew inferences of probability arising from Mr. Lachaud's circumstances and the circumstances of publication and the likelihood of future serious harm. So inferences were explicitly said to be possible in such circumstances or similar circumstances, and they've even been found to be possible in the case of in Section 1-2 cases involving financial loss. There's a 2018 case, the case of Eureco Fuels Limited and Sechin, and in that case it was held that inferences could be drawn even to establish financial loss.
Thank you. Moving on to slide 13, I'm going to briefly talk about the defence of honest opinion, which is in Section 3 of the Act. By way of general reminder, the defence arises where three conditions are met. The statement was a statement of opinion. It indicated the basis of the opinion, and the opinion could have been held by an honest person on the basis of facts that existed at the time of publication. Given the way in which Section 3 was drafted, a number of uncertainties have arisen in applying the defence of honest opinion. And we're going to look at three specific points which have been clarified in recent case law and which are indicated on the slide. The first point relates to the distinction between statements of facts and statements of opinion. This is a crucial distinction because the Section 3 defence is only available in relation to statements of opinion, which are essentially not verifiable and have an element of evaluation. The distinction between fact and opinion is one which is decided by the judge frequently in tandem with the issue of meaning at a preliminary issue trial, which we were just discussing. It's by no means a straightforward exercise, although the case law has now given guidance as to how it should be approached. And the main case on this issue is the case of Koutsoujanis, which I've referenced in the slides, and I've also taken you to the relevant paragraphs on the case on the slide itself. Ultimately, the question that must be asked is, how would those words strike the ordinary reasonable reader? And in answering this question, the subject matter and the context of the words may be an important indicator as to whether the words are actually a statement of fact or a statement of opinion. As an aside, an interesting fact, as a matter of practice, at a meaning PIT, when the judge determines which part of the statement relates to the facts and which part of the statement constitutes an opinion, he may also indicate which facts must be proven to be true in order for the defendant to be able to rely on the Section 3 defence. And this is something which obviously assists the parties with their pleadings in the next stages of the proceedings. Turning to the second point, the second source of uncertainty in relation to the Section 3 defence was or is the issue which arises in relation to implied or inferred opinions based on factual statements, and whether in those circumstances a defence of honest opinion is available. There are two cases which nicely illustrate this issue and which are referenced in the slide, so the cases of Tinkler and Shake. I'm going to illustrate the difficulties encountered in relation to this by reference to Tinkler, and we don't have time to go to Shake, but the references are there in case you want to have a look. So in the case of Tinkler, the claimant was an individual who was a director of a group of companies and who brought proceedings against other members of the group's board of directors. And the proceedings related to a statement which had been published by the defendant and which declared that the claimant intended to vote against the re-election of one of the directors, whereas the rest of the group would vote in favour of that re-election. One of the meanings that had been pleaded by the claimant was that he had been acting in breach of his fiduciary duties. But in fact, no opinion to that effect was stated in the announcement. And this is what Mr. Justice Nicklin in that case referred to as an inferred opinion, which is an opinion which is not expressed as the view of the author, but which nevertheless emerges clearly as the result of discernible indications in the text as to what the author's opinion actually is on the given facts. This is clearly a very subjective exercise, and Mr. Justice Nicklin warned that in the circumstances, such as the ones in Tinkler, the reality could simply be that the reader is actually supplying his or her own opinion on the facts given by the author, rather than detecting the author's opinion by implication. And if that is the case, then the statement will not be a statement of opinion. It will be a statement of fact for which the Section 3 defense is not available. So ultimately, the conclusion to that is that it is very important to distinguish the facts and or the opinion stated by the author of a statement from the opinions, the judgments, the conclusions that can be drawn by the reader of a statement. One last point, the last point that's listed on the slides, which has given rise to some difficulties in applying Section 3, is the status of an inference of fact. It is now accepted that an inference of fact is actually a form of opinion for which a Section 3 defense will be available. And this was recently affirmed in the Court of Appeal case of Butt and Secretary of State for the Home Department, which was a case which related to the publication of a press release about tackling extremism, which referred to the claimant, who was a website editor, as an extreme hate speaker. The relevant statement and the words complained of was presented to the readers of the statement as an assessment or evaluation carried out by the extremism analysis unit, which had been reached by the unit by looking at the claimant's public pronouncements and then assessing how they would conform to British values. And the Court of Appeal agreed with the first instance judge that the words complained of were a statement of opinion. Their assessment in that regard was that the issue as to whether the words stated by an individual express views that conform to a given set of values, in this case, British values, was a value judgment that was inherently subjective and that would be recognised as such by readers. So on the facts of the case, the words, the public pronouncements of the claimant, which were analysed by the defendant, were a fact. But the defendant's conclusion, on the basis of their assessment as to whether those pronouncements actually conform with British values, was a statement of opinion.
Thank you, Mathilde. That's very interesting. Are there any situations in which the honest opinion defence can be used to support an underlying factual situation which is untrue? Shall I say that again?
Yeah.
That's very interesting, Mathilde. Are there any circumstances in which the honest opinion defence that can support facts which are untrue?
Well, that's a good question. It's one that has arisen actually in the case of Morgan and Associated newspaper. And in that case, counsel for the defendant sought to run a line of argument that the defendant could plead and prove any facts which existed at the time of publication and upon which an honest person could have held the opinion. So in other words, the argument that was being run was that the facts on which the defendant was relying should not be limited to the facts expressed in, and stated in the article complained of or in any form of statement complained of, but would just have to be facts which satisfy the test in Section 3. The issue was not determined by the judge in the case of Morgan, but Mr. Justice Nicklin indicated that it would be unlikely that the court would allow a Section 3 defence to succeed in circumstances where there was no nexus between the pleaded facts supporting the opinion and what was actually stated in the statement complained of.
So moving on to the public interest defence in Section 4 of the Defamation Act, the significant judgment here, the landmark judgment here, is one handed down in June by the Supreme Court. It's its second ruling in as many years on the ambit of the Defamation Act. In Seraphin, we got much needed guidance on the correct operation of Section 4, a defence which provides that the publication of a defamatory statement concerning a matter of public interest can be defended on the basis that whoever published it reasonably believed that to do so was in the public interest. In reaching its judgment, the Supreme Court firmly rejected the Court of Appeal's restrictive take on the scope of Section 4. The court, it was wrong, in Lord Wilson's words, to state that the Reynolds defence, which I'll move on to later, and the Section 4 defence are not materially different, for the elements of the two cannot be equated. So he was very firmly saying there that they are different beasts, the common law and the new act. Seraphin is going to have an immediate positive effect on freedom of expression, in my opinion. Pre-publication legal advice to publishers of stories or people wanting to publish stories concerning matters of public interest where the allegations can't be proved to be true, which is often the case, will now be able to refocus on the words of the statute and abandon any strained gloss applied to them under the pre-existing common law. So just to briefly recap what Section 4 actually says, it says that in subsection 1, it says it's a defence to an action for defamation for the defendant to show that the statement complained of was or formed part of a statement on a matter of public interest. And 1AB, the defendant reasonably believed that publishing the statement complained of was in the public interest. Now, those two subsections, A and B, actually constitute three separate tests, which I will move on to at the end. We'll consider that after looking at what the Supreme Court held. It's worth noting for now that subsection 6 of Section 4 specifically explicitly abolishes the common law defence known as the Reynolds defence, and we should have a quick counter through the principal common law roots of Section 4. The Reynolds defence arose from a House of Lords judgment in 1999 after the former Irish Prime Minister Albert Reynolds sued the Times over their coverage of his political activities. In his judgment, in Lord Nicholls' judgment, he famously recognised a new defence of what he called common law privilege, which attaches to articles, which attached at that time to articles published in the public interest. He constructed that defence, or he based it on the duty interest test used in the law of confidence. So there had to be a mutuality of interest there. And Lord Nicholls identified 10, a list of 10 examples of factors going to good journalistic standards. And those examples subsequently became known as the Reynolds checklist. And in fact, they were certainly used by claimant lawyers as a tick box exercise. And even in pre-publication advice, it's fair to say, it became a slightly sort of over-rigid set of hurdles, which was never intended to be so by Lord Nicholls. He actually called it a non-exhaustive list at the time that he set out those examples. The public interest defence was next considered or tweaked, let's say, by the House of Lords in the case of Jameel against the Wall Street Journal. That was a case involving the allegation that Mr. Jameel's, one of his business interests was being investigated by the Saudi authorities. Now, Baroness Hill said in Jameel that the Reynolds defence was a different jurisprudential creature from the law of privilege. So the Reynolds privilege label was removed by the House of Lords in Jameel. And the defence was renamed the Reynolds Public Interest Defence. The reciprocal duty interest test was abandoned. And it was reiterated that whilst a journalist's conduct was material to the defence, none of the factors on the Reynolds checklist was an essential prerequisite, including significantly a defendant's failure to seek comment from the subject of an allegation. And that was particularly relevant, pertinent to the facts of Jamil, because Mr. Jamil, in fact, hadn't even been aware that his of the allegation or the fact that he was being investigated by the Saudi authorities. So it would have been pointless to go to him for comment, because he didn't even know that that this was supposedly happening to him. 5 years or so later came the case of Flood. The Supreme Court again looked at the public interest defense. That was an article about alleged police corruption in the Times. And in doing so, the Supreme Court significantly widened the ambit of the public interest defense, emphasizing as it did so that it was important to give respect within reason to editorial judgment in relation not only to the steps to be taken by way of verification prior to publication. This was this hinged on steps that a responsible journalist ought to take to verify an allegation before publishing it. So the Supreme Court made it clear that one had to give respect to editorial judgment as to whether it was necessary to do that or not, but also to what it would be in the public interest to publish. So that did widen the ambit of the defence, but the required standard was still said in Flood to be that of responsible journalism. So this responsible journalist phrase was still critical to the defence. Moving on to Lord Leicester's defamation bill, after much consultation and pre-legislative debate, both the common law concept of responsible journalism, which had been in early versions of the bill, and the Reynolds list of factors, which had also appeared in early versions of the bill, were abandoned by Parliament as they were too complicated and inflexible, and in any case couldn't be applied to lay publishers who couldn't be expected to adhere to standards of responsible journalism. So they were found not to cover all the circumstances in which something in the public interest might justifiably be published. Instead of those prescriptive lists and terminology, clause 4.2 was added, which just said that the court should have regard to all the circumstances of the case when ruling on the test of at 4.1. In other words, when ruling on whether a journalist's belief was reasonable that it was in the public interest to publish. Lord McNally told the committee scrutinising the bill that this would send a signal to the courts and practitioners to make clear the wish of Parliament that the new defence should be applied in as flexible a way as possible. And it's worth remembering that when looking at what happened next. Economy and Freitas was the first Section 4 case to reach the Court of Appeal. The defendant was the father of Eleanor de Freitas, who was a young lady who very sadly took her own life the day before she was her first appearance in the Magistrates Court on charges of perverting the course of justice by falsely alleging that she had been raped by the claimant. After his daughter's death, David de Freitas had given several media interviews questioning the CPS decision to take over what had initially been the claimant's private prosecution of Eleanor de Freitas. At first instance in the libel case, Mr. Justice Warby, and followed by the Court of Appeal, in fact, found that the father's discussion of the prosecution of rape complainants, how that was undertaken in this country, was a matter which engaged the public interest. And Mr. Justice Warby's judgment was notable also for its recognition that sources of stories published by the media may avail themselves of the Section 4 defence, which is something you'll remember that the committee had specifically envisaged. Of course, in Economy and Freitas, it wasn't the publishers of the father's and the broadcasters of the father's allegations that were sued. It was the source, Mr. de Freitas, so hence the relevance of Mr. Justice Warby's finding on that. The case of Seraphin was the first Section 4 case against media publishers to reach the Court of Appeal. It concerns a piece in a Polish language newspaper published and read by the Polish diaspora in West London concerning the personal, the colourful business life and personal life of Mr. Seraphin, who was a Polish builder who'd lived in the UK for several decades. The meaning of the allegations in the article included that Mr. Serafin had allegedly fraudulently profited at the expense of the charitable organisations for which he volunteered, obtained a series of loans and investments into his business from various individuals, including two women to whom he was simultaneously romantically attached. At trial, Mr. Justice Jay was very unimpressed by Mr. Serafin and highly critical of him. He found that most of the allegations in the article were proved. He held that the public interest defence in Section 4 applied to the publication of all the allegations, whether proven or not. The Court of Appeal disagreed. They overturned Mr. Justice Jay's factual findings, and that was something that was something with which this, the Supreme Court eventually agreed as well, and the case is now being remitted to a different judge for rehearing on the facts, but with the direction that the law, as the Supreme Court found it, be used to interpret Section 4. The Court of Appeal disagreed that the publication of the article was in the public interest. They thought that the doings of a charitable organisation didn't engage the public interest because they weren't a matter of public debate, amongst other reasons. The Court of Appeal revived the old common law principles to rule on the new statutory defence, finding that appropriate, reasonable journalistic standards had not been met by the defendants, and adding that they had failed to adhere to a basic requirement of fairness and responsible journalism, largely because Mr. Serafin hadn't been contacted to comment on the allegations before they'd been published, something which the Court of Appeal found was a missing core requirement of Section 4. The Court of Appeal cited Lord Nicholls, they revived and with approval Lord Nicholls' old 10-point checklist of factors, and they asserted their enduring relevance to appropriate journalistic standards, and as I said, even elevating one to the status of a requirement, and that is that a subject of an allegation be contacted for comment. I won't go into the reasons why, but the Court of Appeal rejected as irrelevant the explanations, the reasonable belief of the explanations given by the defendants to underpin their reasonable belief that even if they had gone to Mr. Serafin, the comment wouldn't have been forthcoming. Given the apparent glaring inconsistencies between the Court of Appeal's take on Section 4 in Economou and the different panels, Court of Appeal panels take on Section 4 in Serafin, the Supreme Court was asked to clarify the scope and ambit of the Section 4 public interest defence as part of its determination on the Serafin case. Lord Wilson upheld that reference to a checklist was now inappropriate. He added that reference to a journalist, to responsible journalism, or to a journalist acting responsibly is also best avoided. He said that failure to invite comment from a claimant prior to publication may contribute to a conclusion that the defendant does not establish that element of the defence, but it is too strong to describe it as a requirement, so that goes out of the window. He said that references to the defence being a form of qualified privilege were also completely wrong, because this was a new statutory defence, and the Court of Appeal's reference to a necessary balancing exercise between competing Article 8 and Article 10 rights was also unhelpful, said Lord Wilson, because they are catered for by the correct operation of Section 4's three requirements. So I said earlier that although it's Section 4.1 is divided into A and B, it actually is made up of three requirements, and this is the effect of the Serafin judgment. Firstly, that a statement be on a matter of public interest, which is a straightforward objective question predicated on what is the subject matter of the publication. If it concerns a matter of public interest, then that first test is satisfied. The second test is a court would have to look at a defendant's subjective belief that publishing the statement complained of was in the public interest. And whether that belief is reasonable depends on, firstly, the defendant having actually applied their minds to the question of whether it will be in the public interest to publish. And this is where we go back to the audit trail and keeping how helpful it is in this regard to keep some to think about it carefully before publication, and also to keep some form of a record of what the thinking was, because it will come in mighty useful if you find yourself being sued for libel and you want to run a public interest defence. There have been, I haven't got time to go into them now, I've listed them on slide 15, but there have been several cases where the defence, section 4 defence, has failed because a defendant hasn't been able to establish that they formed such a belief that publication would be in the public interest. And I briefly indicated on that slide what the reasons were and the paragraphs in which, in the judgments in which you can read about this. And so what Lord Wilson has done really is to revive the public interest defence, to allow it room to breathe and to release it from the shackles that it had been found itself locked in by the Court of Appeal.
Thanks, Romana. I know that when you've said about comment and seeking comment from an individual who's going to be the subject matter of a publication, so what would your advice be to someone who comes to you for pre-publication advice? Would you tell them to go and seek comment from them?
Yes, in general, I would. I think we must remember that Lord Wilson said that it will be a rare case. These are his words. It will be a rare case, in my view, he said, where it will be deemed reasonable for a defendant not to have gone to a claimant for comment. So he does say this. And there will be cases. There were cases, there were circumstances. Jamil was one of those cases. There will be situations where there are situations indeed where claimants deliberately make themselves unavailable for comments. So there will be times where it's not appropriate, but on the whole, yes, I would generally advise a defendant publisher to make sure that they do make attempts, reasonable attempts, including giving a claimant enough time to respond to an allegation.
Thanks. We're going to wrap up our section looking at substantive developments in the law of defamation by looking at two other sections in less detail. These are sections 9 and 12. So turning to slide 16, we're going to look at section 9 and the issue of jurisdiction in the first instance. The issue of jurisdiction is one that was considered and by Parliament when it enacted the Defamation Act 2013, and they considered it with a view to preventing libel tourism, that is, instances where a foreign claimant would come to the UK to sue a foreign defendant in order to take advantage of English libel laws, which they saw as being favourable to them. With this in mind, Section 9 introduces a jurisdictional bar to such claims, and it provides that where a defendant in a libel claim is not domiciled in the United Kingdom, in a member state of the European Union, or in a state that is a contracting party to the Lugano Convention, then the claimant must show that of all of the places where the statement complained of has been published, England and Wales is clearly the most appropriate jurisdiction to bring the proceedings. In the recent case of Wright and Ver, it has become very clear that this jurisdictional bar is not an easy one to overcome. That claim was a claim brought by an Australian national who had lived in the UK for 4 years against a Bitcoin investor who was originally a US citizen but had renounced that citizenship, become a citizen of St. Kitts and Nevis, and was living in Japan. It's very clear on this set of facts that there were a lot of jurisdictional difficulties that may arise with this claim, but the crux of the claimant's case was that he had immigrated to the UK with his family from Australia in December 2015. The UK was where, the place where he was carrying out his business, where the people with whom he primarily dealt with were based, and therefore that it was clearly the most appropriate place for him to bring proceedings. So despite filing no less than 7 witness statements, the claimant actually failed to overcome the Section 9 requirement because he had failed to address the extent of his global reputation and more specifically, the jurisdiction in which he had allegedly suffered the most damage. In the light of this, the court considered that it was somewhat blindfolded and that it couldn't properly satisfy itself that the Section 9 requirement had been met. In the Court of Appeal, guidance was given as to the type of requirements that should be addressed in evidence in order to overcome the jurisdictional bar in Section 9. And these are quite self-explanatory. They would include things such as listing the jurisdictions in which publication has been made, the extent of publication in each jurisdiction, identifying the target audience for the publication, and engaging in a sort of comparative exercise to look at all the different jurisdictions and considering whether in other candidate jurisdictions there is a fair judicial process, whether there are effective remedies, whether the costs of the proceedings might be prohibitive. So all of these factors are factors to take into account when considering the issue of Section 9. Another point to keep in mind is that in the present circumstances, Section 9 is only applicable where the defendant is not based in the UK, in another member state of the EU, or in a state which is a contracting party to the Lugano Convention. What that means is that in the present circumstances, a claimant can actually issue proceedings for libel in England and Wales against a defendant who's domiciled, say, in Italy or in France. And they will not have to overcome the Section 9 test. What will happen, though, is that their remedies will be more limited. And so unless they can prove that the claimant's centre of interest was in England and Wales, then they will only be able to recover for the part of the damage that was suffered in England and Wales. And importantly, they will not be able to ask the court to order an injunction against online publication, which is a very significant point in considering whether or not the effect of any judgment will actually be effective. The UK's exit from the European Union is coming to impact the rules on jurisdiction quite directly. This is a point that was addressed in the court of by the Court of Appeal in the case of Wright and Burr, in which it reminded its readers that although Section 9 currently only applies in the circumstances I've described, from the 1st of January 2021, Section 9 will actually apply to all cases where the defendant is not domiciled in the UK. What that means in practice is that Section 9, which we've seen presents quite a difficult jurisdictional bar for claimants wanting to claim against foreign defendants, Section 9 will actually increase its reach.
Right. How does the claimant go about proving that his centre of interest is in England and Wales?
So some guidance has been given about this, both by the CJU in the case of E-Date, but also in the High Court in the case of Wafik Saeed and L'Express. Generally speaking, a centre of interest is likely to correspond to the person's habitual residence. But the European Court also referred to the place where the individual enjoys his personality rights and where he's carrying out his life plans. Two things to bear in mind when assessing these factors is that there can only be one centre of interest and not multiple ones, and that it is possible that an individual has interests that are so diffuse that there's actually not one centre of interest that can be identified. This is not a straightforward exercise, and as I said, in any event, this is something that will become less relevant from the 1st of January 2021. Bringing an end to this section on substantive law, in slide 17, I've looked at section 12 of the Defamation Act. It's worth mentioning this section because it introduces a new mechanism available to vindicate the claimant's reputation. You may be aware, a court cannot order a defendant to apologize in libel proceedings. The circumstances in which an apology is a requirement is in the limited circumstances of an offer of amends, but otherwise, as I said, no apology can be ordered. And with this in mind, the fact that Section 12 makes provision for the court to order the publication of a summary of proceedings is something that is quite interesting in terms of remedies available to a claimant to vindicate their reputation. On the slide, I've listed two cases, the cases of Raman and the case of Gannucci, which are the two cases which, to my knowledge, have made Section 12 orders. And there's not much to be said about these cases beyond that, other than orders were made under Section 12 there. And that, when I think, based on our current practice, is that it's quite important when asking for a Section 12 order to ask for accompanying directions as to the form of publication and where the Section 12 is going to be published in order to ensure maximum effectiveness of the statement.
And what about if the pleadings, if that relief wasn't sought in the claim form, if a Section 12 publication wasn't asked for at that stage, does that mean that it's not available to the claimant?
No, not necessarily. I mean, there's no reason in principle why the court would not make an order under Section 12 without it being pleaded. I know that requests for such orders are actually making their way into pleadings now, but the reality is really often the pleadings in any event are seeking further or other relief, which would cover Section 12. And in one of the two cases that are listed on the slide, the case of Raman, the issue of the publication of a Section 12 statement was actually dealt with by way of consequential submissions after the main judgment and the decision on damages had been given. So it seems to me that this is a pretty good indication that that would not be a bar. We are going to briefly look at procedural changes in the law of defamation. These are on, so the main title is on slide 18, but turning immediately to slide 19, we can look at some main procedural changes which have been enforced since the 1st of October 2019 and which will be of interest to anyone who is interested in the practice of libel litigation. So on the 1st of October 2019, various procedural changes came into force, and at the forefront of these changes was the creation of the Media and Communications List, which is now a specialist list within the Queen's Bench Division. On the same date, a new pre-action protocol for media and communications claim came into force, and a new CPR Rule 53 came into force with two accompanying practice directions. There's been two main changes for libel professionals arising from these procedural changes. The first is that the first arises from the new pre-action protocol. It's not that different from its predecessor insofar as libel claims are concerned, but it does include a requirement to set out the claimant's case on serious harm in the letter of claim, and that is something that was not previously a requirement. And the second point, which has a more direct impact on practice, is that all High Court claims, which include a claim for defamation, for misuse of private information, for harassment or for breach of data protection laws, now need to be issued in the Media and Communications List. This is a noteworthy change because up until then, data protection claims were actually regularly issued in the general list of the Queen's Bench or the Chancery Divisions. And there were some libel claims which were proceeding in the Chancery Division, sometimes because this was a tactical choice where where the claimant thought that he may get, for instance, a more generous award of damages in the Chancery division.
So, Mathilde, are there any kinds of media claim which can now be issued outside the media and communications list?
Well, there remains a possibility. You may be aware of the proceedings issued by the Duchess of Sussex against ANL, which are currently proceeding in the IP list of the Chancery Division. This is, on the face of it, quite surprising because the driver of the case clearly appears to be the misuse of private information claim. But these proceedings actually include a claim for infringement of copyright, and strictly speaking, the inclusion of such a claim means that because of the rules in the Senior Courts Act 1981 and in CPR 63, the proceedings had to be issued in the IP list on the Chancery Division. There are a number of counterexamples of claims which did include a claim for infringement of copyright, and which actually proceeded in the Queen's Bench Division. But ultimately, it means that, yes, that there is some room for some media claims to proceed in other divisions. And lastly, on libel practice and bringing an end to the substantive part of the seminar and leading into the conclusion, just a word about costs on slide 20. Libel proceedings have historically been identified as complex, expensive proceedings, and they were actually characterized by Lord Justice Jackson as the most bizarre and expensive system that it was possible to devise. However, he also recognized that in a paradigm libel case, what you have is a claimant who is an individual of modest means who is trying to bring proceedings against a well-resourced media organization. And with this in mind, these are factors to keep in mind when looking at the general system of funding in libel proceedings, which involves the possibility of acting on a no-win, no-fee basis. And this possibility of acting on a no-win, no-fee basis and of recovering a success fee from one's opponent in the case of success in libel proceedings, the system was criticized as bringing a bar or as interfering with the defendant's right to the Article 10 right to freedom of expression. And this has led from April 2019 to the abolition of the recoverability of success fees in libel claims. So what that means is that you can still proceed on a conditional fee basis, but you will not be able to recover success fees. Other forms of additional liabilities, such as insurance premiums, remain recoverable. And the date to keep in mind for this, the cutoff date, is the 6th of April 2019, and essentially for CFAs entered into on that date or thereafter, no success fee will be recoverable. This is something that really has changed the practice of libel proceedings.
So if the success fees are no longer recoverable, do you still have to notify your opponent that you're acting under a CFA?
Yeah, absolutely. The point of the obligation is to put the other side on notice that additional liabilities are recoverable. And although the recoverability of success fees has been abolished, insurance premiums can still be recovered, as I was saying. So the notification obligation remains relevant. And in fact, in the new pre-action protocol for media and communications claim, there is a specific requirement to notify the defendant of any funding arrangements in place. That's it for me on the procedure and on costs. So I'll hand over to you now, Romana, to conclude.
Yeah, so just to wrap up today's seminar, just a couple of observations. Firstly, as we see online platforms for publication increase from mainstream news providers, most of which host user-generated comment, to citizen bloggers and many shades in between, we can anticipate a corresponding interest in claims arriving from defamatory social media posts. They can lead to substantial awards of damages or bruising settlements, as Alan Davis said in that he learned in 2013 the hard way, having retweeted a Burko tweet and being sued by Lord McAlpine. This was the statement that Davis subsequently issued through his solicitors. It's obviously years since I inadvertently tweeted a message which named Lord McAlpine. Throughout, I've stood by the original public apology that I issued in November last year, making it clear that the allegations about him were false. But from my own experience, I'm able to warn others of the dangers of retweeting. Well, that was an early warning, but it hasn't been heeded, it seems. It was overlooked, apparently, by the defendant, Tim Monier and Wood, in 2018. Mr. Wood was the former chairman of UKIP's Bristol branch. He was held liable for a defamatory message posted on the branch's Twitter account, even though it hadn't been posted by himself. He was nonetheless held liable. There was the Keyboard Warrior case, where Samantha Walker, in 2019, had to pay Kim Suttle £55,000 in libel and harassment damages. So that was the case that I was referring to earlier on, where harassment by publication by one citizen against another on social media can lead to substantial awards of damages. That case revolved around false allegations published by Samantha Walker that Kim Suttle was cruel to dogs. There was the case in 2019, shortly after that, where Peter North, another UKIP person, this time the parliamentary candidate and founder of the Leave Alliance, was ordered to pay AC Grayling £20,000 in libel damages after tweeting an allegation that the philosopher and academic was in possession of child pornography, obviously a false allegation there. However, it would be wrong to leave you without a mention of the so-called trial of the century. Although it was a straightforward Section 2 case, Johnny Depp's hotly contested High Court claim against newsgroup newspapers over allegations made by his former wife, Amber Heard, pushed the pandemics out of the headlines for a welcome 16 days back in July. And Mr. Justice Nichols' judgment in that case is awaited in the autumn.